Hello and welcome to the wild cartoon kingdom of Gamer Era.
I realized I did the baby voice on episode 7, so you get Budget Bin Peter Lorre instead. Hello, welcome to Gamer Era. As always, with an absolutely inscrutable intro, I'm your host, Sam, and we will be talking about cartoons. We will be getting gunged. We will be going through the oh-so-nostalgic 90s that I wasn't alive for about half of, but I have brought a so-called elder statesman in to guide me through. And who are they on the line?
Sorry, I'm still recovering from your opening.
It just unfurls. It's like a fruit wind-up that just... you just start unspooling it and it doesn't stop.
I did not anticipate the impression.
Every episode's got to have a gimmick.
You're so right. Hello. It's like a Sonic game. Everyone got to have its own special flavor.
It does.
Hi, it's Kit again.
Hello.
I'm back.
Welcome
I'm back,
back.
Baby.
From the Splatoon episode.
Indeed.
David, as he said at the end of last episode, is in cryogenic sleep. I folded him over like a mummy, and he's in the land of Nod. But that means that the bad boys come out to play, I suppose.
Indeed.
It doesn't mean that much different.
No.
It just means we get to rant and rave a bit more about cartoons.
Yes.
So how has your gaming era been? How's it been since you were last on the pod? Because it's been a few months. It was in April, I think, we recorded for the Splatoon episode.
Yes, I think last time I was playing Persona 3.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah. Well, right off the back of that, I went straight into playing yet another 100-hour JRPG. This time it was Infinite Wealth.
Which is
a fantastic game. If you've never played any of the Yakuza games, you can actually probably just start with that one. It's so good.
Yeah.
I'm so into Ichiban as a protag. He's such a good flavor.
He's really resonated with people. We've got quite a few Yakuza fans like in the server and stuff, so it's like it's always fun whenever it comes up.
I played that, and then funnily enough, after spending I guess essentially the first half of the year playing nothing but long 100-hour games, I think I burnt out a bit, and I have just been hopping between all sorts, particularly something that is related to what I'm on the pod for today.
Yes.
That has started off a whole sort of slew of me getting really into emulating and playing retro games. So I've even gotten myself an Anbernic, and I've been playing stuff on there. I just finished a Pokemon Red Nuzlocke. I actually completed it, which was nice.
Yeah.
Painful game.
I heard you lost your starter, right?
I lost the first Pokemon I lost was my Charmeleon. Bad start to the game. Not even to Brock. It was to like a rogue Rattata that knew Hyper Fang.
It's always Rattatas. Do they have like a really high attack stat or something? Are they just like completely busted
something,
in Gen 1?
Yeah, something I was noticing in Gen 1 is that I think crit is way more common.
Yeah.
Like, critting was insanely common.
Yeah.
On both sides. I was noticing so much crit. And Hyper Fang with a higher crit rate is devastating in that game.
Yeah.
I managed to do it in the end. Never did manage to finish the game with a fire type. I got a Growlithe at one point and that died as well.
No.
So I ended up having to kind of mishmash a team together. I did kind of fudge the numbers a little bit. I used a bunch of repels in the power plant so that I could get to Zapdos.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, because I had the Master Ball and I was like, right, this will probably help me survive Elite Four.
Yeah, I never thought about that, the meta of the Master Ball in the context of a Nuzlocke, because that is like, that is your Hail Mary, essentially, especially for going straight to a legendary like that.
Yep. So I went for grabbing Zapdos, and then I managed to... I almost fell to Lorelei, like, the first Elite Four member, because I was really... I just didn't have a team set up for her. It was really bad. But I managed to only lose Lapras to that, and then I got through everyone else pretty much unscathed, apart from my Venomoth.
Yeah.
I literally just finished that today.
Nice. Have you done any Nuzlocke before? I forget, because I know you've watched a few, but...
Yeah, it's been a while. Funnily enough, I think the last one I did was... The last one I did might have been Black and White. I don't remember how it went, though. I remember I have done a Pokemon Red and Blue one before, though.
Yeah.
Way, way back. I think I did all right there as well. I think I did another sort of fudging the numbers thing where I played in the game corner and just got a load of coins and then bought a Dratini
in that one.
Which, as long as you can keep the Dratini alive, then obviously that works out pretty well.
Oh, yeah, God, of course, the dragon advantage in Gen 1.
Absolutely. There's like no dragon moves to make up for it, so it's really like a advantage of type rather than an advantage of move.
Yeah.
Dragon moves that I think exist might be, I can't remember if Twister exists, and then Dragon Rage, which does, I think both of those do set damage, so it's just like, it's pointless.
Yeah, exactly.
So if anything, I kind of built around having ice moves on like three Pokemon, I think, just in prep for Lance, which worked out. But yeah, so I've just been noodling around on sort of shorter stuff that I can get through quite quickly. How about yourself? How's your era of gaming been lately?
God, it's been massive. Like, we didn't have much time to talk about it on the last episode because we had the big Wordle talk, and then David had some talk of his own, mostly about Lego Indiana Jones. We sort of touched on like Rayman, and I've been kind of going through the series because since I picked up the deck, I saw it as kind of a good opportunity to play a lot of the sort of fan games and mods and stuff that I hadn't had a chance to play before. So I've been playing Rayman Redemption, which is the widescreen sort of fan remake of Rayman 1, but they kind of...
Right.
They rebalance a lot of stuff. They make some stuff easier, but then they also make some stuff like kind of more interesting. They sort of mix and match bits and pieces from all the different ports. It's by this guy Romani, who's like kind of just really like loves that first game and really loves going in on the granular detail. He's currently making a spiritual successor called Connie and the Essence of Chaos, I think it is. So that's quite exciting. And then that also just sort of got me interested in playing like more of the Rayman games. So I went back to Rayman 2, the Dreamcast version, which is always like a joy to play. Played a little bit of Rayman 3 again. That one always like kind of splits me because it feels like they don't fully know where to go in terms of tone. It's like, it's got some of the sort of mysticism and the general like fog and the atmosphere of Rayman 2, but they've kind of woven in a sort of Conker's Bad Fur Day style like irreverence.
Oh.
They don't go as far as like an M rating, obviously.
No.
But they're kind of, it's that kind of cheeky like French style of humor that's kind of like, it can be kind of hit and miss. You can kind of feel certain things maybe don't translate super well or something.
Yeah, like kind of like a version of Rabbids in a way, because that's a little bit
it's definitely a prelude to Rabbids, you can feel that. And it's still quite fun, but it's like it's much more moment to moment and arcadey. Like the stages are very linearly broken up, whereas Rayman 2, they're still linear stages, but you still feel like you can explore a bit more and stuff. But I've been having a lot of fun playing all of those. In the same vein, I've been playing some Sonic fan games as well. So
nice.
I played a bit more of Project 06, which was the sort of fan remake of Sonic 06. I forget what they made it in. I don't know if it was Unity or Unreal, but it was basically born from like a fan who always wanted to play Sonic 06 and loved the idea of Sonic 06, but could never actually like afford the console and just started like building a version of the game based off all the like screenshots and videos and information they could find. Eventually they did get their hands on the game. They used that as like reference material, but it's this kind of like, what if they'd got to like actually polish the game up, but it's still like the level design and everything's the same. The physics are quite faithful, but it's like the main idea is like polishing up the stuff that they clearly just kind of ran out of time to do. The main thing that's kind of fun about it is it does kind of trim the fat as well. Where the original game had those like adventure fields you go around and you talk to people and you do all these like sort of side quests, and some of them are kind of cute and they kind of establish an atmosphere, but sometimes it's really odd. There's that quite famous one where you like talk to a guard and they're like, oh, you have to find you have to talk to all the guards and find the one guard who's lying or something, and then if you just talk to him again, he's like, oh, what, you think I'm the guard? And then you say yes, he's like, yes, that's right, I was the right guard. And then it just ends. You genuinely spend longer in the like loading screens before and after the quest than actually doing it. It doesn't make any, it's just like, it's so silly.
So much about that game is either silly or just unforgivable.
Yeah.
And like, oh, the loading between tiny 5-second missions like that is the worst.
Yeah. And it's so vindicating playing this version when it does, like, because the stages are split into like multiple different areas and loading zones and stuff. But like the loading is like instant. It's like literally it does the animation once and then you're into the next bit.
Oh, beautiful.
And it feels great. I think they're doing some finishing touches on it. I think they said they're not going to do the adventure field stuff, but they might put like cutscenes in between so you can still like experience the full game. Kind of brings it closer to like Sonic Adventure 2 than Sonic Adventure 1.
Yes, I was going to say, like, yeah. This is the funny thing is 06 really, really was essentially Adventure 3.
It really is. People said it at first to just sort of get a rise out of people, but it's like the more you look at it, and the more you look at it, like Heroes isn't really like Sonic Adventure 3.
It's like there's elements.
Yeah.
There's definitely elements of adventure design sort of ethos in there, because I've played Heroes recently as well. And yeah, there's elements of that where it's still very that type of gameplay of adventure era, but slowly starting to go toward boost era as well. I think it's interesting. Heroes is an odd one.
Yeah, and then like Sonic Unleashed has like some of the world exploration stuff and like the weird like NPCs you talk to and some of the side quests and things. But then it's the start of the boost formula. The actual stage gameplay is completely different.
Yes.
Yeah, it's really fun just getting this game. Seeing, because it's like 06 really split people, and I think it's more
for good
about,
reason.
Like, yeah, absolutely. I think people have evaluated in years since to be like, it's kind of, there was some potential there, but it was just kind of squandered by the time limit.
Yeah, whereas deadlines like the need to get it out for holiday, wasn't it? It was a holiday release, they decided. Yeah. Which, if it just had that bit of extra time in the oven, we could maybe have ended up with something that is like Project 06.
Yeah, and obviously the wildest part being Yuji Naka leaving Sonic Team halfway through, and then the team also getting split and having to work on Secret Rings at the same time. Because they really wanted to do a Wii version of 06, and then when they actually got the specs for the Wii, they were like,
that ain't happening.
Which is, it made it all the funnier when they announced Sonic Forces and they were like, it's coming to NX. It's like, you don't even know what NX is, and you're just saying it.
I know, God.
It was like, and it was like the exact sort of same mistake. I mean, Forces wasn't so bad on Switch, but I do remember it was 30 FPS. Which, whatever. And the
I mean,
voices
as long
were
as
very
it's
compressed.
Stable.
Yeah, it was stable at least. It wasn't like Colors Ultimate where the loading took forever and there were like strobe effects happening in the stages from the textures falling apart.
Oh, fuck.
But yeah, that's been fun. I played a few of the... another fan did like some remasters of the Sonic Game Gear games. Those have a sort of soft spot in my heart. I kind of prefer the 8-bit version of Sonic 1 to the 16-bit, Because obviously the 16-bit starts out with Green Hill, it's all and then... vibrant, and then you go into Marble, yeah. And it's a, you know, and then it kind of ping-pongs from there. It's like, oh, hey, yeah, Spring Yard, oh, Labyrinth, oh, hey, Starlight, oh,
yeah, and also, like, let's face it, Green Hill plays the best, probably, out of most things in that first game.
Yeah, but Sonic 1 is, like, on the Game Gear and the Master System is just, like, it kind of goes strength to strength.
I need to invest more time in that.
The stage is... It's good. It's a really nice game. If you play the original version, definitely play the Master System one because you get to see a bit more of the screen. But this fan remake is really nice as well. And they're actually doing they did Sonic 2 as well. And they're doing like a speculative Sonic 3 where they're sort of combining bits from Triple Trouble and Chaos. And they're sort of like, what if they had done a 8-bit Sonic 3? Like, what would that be like? So I'm quite excited to get to that one. I think it's still in development, but... the kind of exciting thing about like PC stuff I'm finding is that like a lot of stuff is like constantly in development, so you're always like checking in and seeing where things are at. But yeah, all of that kind of got me in a general sort of platformer kick as well. I played quite a bit of this game called Corn Kids 64, which is this like 3D platformer. It's a weird one because it's essentially like just a single stage. But it's a really big Donkey Kong 64 Banjo-Tooie style stage, and it really captures that sort of feeling of just like getting lost in the world and like exploring and stuff. That was a really nice, like, cheap and cheerful one.
Yeah, that sounds fun.
It's really nice. I'd definitely recommend it. And then the most recent one is a game called Tiny Terry's Turbo Trip, which is like, I kind of just picked it up based entirely off vibes. It's got that very nice sort of flat shaded 3D style. It's not so much a 3D platformer as it is kind of like a Simpsons hit and run style sandbox game. Like, you've got this fairly small self-contained map. You're kind of running around it doing like little missions for characters. But like, again, kind of like Corn Kids, most of it is just like kind of off vibes. The sense of humor really reminds me of like Piku Niku, which was a game I really enjoyed back in lockdown.
Piku Niku is so good.
It's so fun. I remember that went on sale for like, it goes on sale for like £2 or whatever all the time.
It's so worth it.
Yeah, it's just got a great sense of humor. And this one's very similar. So I've been chewing through that. I've got the theme like fully stuck in my head. So as soon as we hop off this, I'll probably be hopping back into that because it's just it's a great little game. But yeah, that's pretty much where my like gaming era has been. There's been like a lot more stuff I've been hopping between as well, but there's kind of stuff I want to sit on and marinate for a bit in case it comes up later for segment material.
Absolutely, yeah.
It's kind of funny, like, since starting the pod, it's like I've been encouraging myself to play a lot more games outside of my regular comfort zone, which has been fantastic. But then sometimes it's like, oh, what do I talk about in the opening segment, and what do I like save, you know, like what's got the juicy story to it for later on.
Hang on, I'm gonna sneeze. No, I'm not. Fuck.
Speaking of juicy stories.
Dear, well, that sneeze is gone forever.
Wow. Lost media. So yeah, last time we had Kit on, they brought up the sort of like Rugrats as one of their earliest sort of games memories. I think you said you played it in like a dentist waiting room or something like that. That might be a David memory.
I feel like you're extrapolating there, but or like creating lore that doesn't exist. You're making lore. But no, Rugrats is I don't even know how I got into Rugrats. Rugrats is one of those properties that just existed when I was a kid.
Yeah.
I was like, when they did the big Rugrats revival, because it obviously it went to like, I think 94, and then they had like a few years break, which gave me time to become old enough to appreciate cartoons. And then they decided to bring it back around 98, 99, which is around when I was 5, 6. So it was a perfect age group, essentially, like right at the beginning of their age group that they were aiming for with Rugrats. And so I just remember the presence of Rugrats and just the Rugrats movie, the games. I remember all of it being omnipresent around the time when I was like 6, along with Pokemon. Like those two things were like essentially right when I was 5 or 6. So I was the target audience for these things. And so I had VHSs. I had like when my dad, I think it was my dad who decided to get a PS1. I don't think I ever asked for one. I think he got one, and then I found out there were Rugrats games on it through probably advertising, and was like, get me them. I need them. I need the Rugrats games.
Yeah.
I need my Blorbos.
Yeah, seriously. It is like that deluge of marketing is like really interesting, because there's obviously a bit of a shared history that Rugrats has, but like it's very reminiscent of like Bartmania for The Simpsons when that sort of started, where it's like everything does really like push the merch. And the core show is still like quality at the end of the day.
But oh, yeah.
Like, the marketing juggernaut really like is fed by the t-shirts and the dolls.
I'm almost certain I remember having I had a Chucky doll with sort of that kind of felt hair. I very much remember that. I have no idea what happened to him in the end. Oh, he might have been one of the toys I lost. I when I was going through the airport as a kid, I insisted on taking a case that was full of toys, like being the one who looked after that as the older sibling, and promptly left said case in an airport. Lost those old Digimon toys that would transform, like the sort of ones that had a zip where it would turn into the Digivolution. I lost a bunch of them, and I assume probably Chucky must have been there too, because I don't know what else could have happened, to be honest. Oh man.
Again, the perils of lost media.
I am not immune to lost media. I have so much lost media.
That's actually quite a good point to springboard from. Because it's like, when you mentioned Rugrats, the gears kind of got turning in my head, and I thought, okay, well, that's one of the first Nicktoons, and you've got the other two big dogs alongside it are like Doug and Ren and Stimpy.
Mm.
Doug we'll briefly touch on, because that's something where I genuinely hadn't heard of it until about a decade ago. I don't know if it was, because that has a weird history where that goes off the air on Nick, and then like Disney buy the rights, and then they start making new episodes that like flash forward in time. And then of course they do Doug's first movie, which funnily enough goes up alongside Pokemon the first movie.
But the difference first movies when I was a kid, man.
Well, the difference is that when 4Kids and the distributors called it Pokemon the first movie, it's because they knew there were already like 2 or 3 more Japanese ones in production. So they were like, oh, you know, Pokemania is huge. This next one's going to be big. Disney were just like, Doug's huge. He's gonna knock stuff. So it's like, yeah, of course it's this first movie. Like, this is going to be a trilogy.
This is our Bart.
It's going to be a saga. Yeah, this is the new Bart. Chucky Finster who? And it's like, I think that's like one of the last Doug things they do. And they do a tie-in game, which I think is, I'm going to just check I've got the name. I think it's called Doug's Big Game, which is the only Doug game they did. It's for the Game Boy Color. came out a year after the movie, and it's, yeah.
I guess it's a big game if it's the only one.
Yeah.
There's nothing making it smaller.
It's the final statement on it. I haven't ever played it. I just know there's a clip of Vinny Vinesauce playing it with a horrendous corruption that comes up at one point.
God.
That's about all I know, though. But then obviously, like, Ren and Stimpy is like the third piece of that puzzle. And it's this kind of initiative from Nickelodeon, who'd been kind of rerunning a lot of old shows and doing like a lot of syndicated content, to finally make their own in-house animation. Mm-hmm. And it's also this general high change from the 80s era of animation, where you've got stuff like He-Man and My Little Pony and G.I. Joe, that's kind of driven by the merch first, and then, you know, everything after that, the actual shows and stuff are like ancillary content. Which is funny to think about, because it's like the games we're talking about are sort of like the offspring. These are like the merchandise of the shows. And in a lot of cases, that's all they're treated as. It's like, it's another thing. It's another box we can slap the characters onto and continue to market the show off, rather than something that sort of like, not so much stands on its own, but like, you know, has the same qualities like an episode of the show, has the same sort of like creative merit.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, like these like early Nicktoons are sort of this big, I think they call it like creator driven stuff, and like more board driven than like script driven ideas.
Yeah.
And Ren and Stimpy kind of, that was like one of the early shooting stars, but that it kind of burnt out quite quickly. As we'll kind of get into with Rugrats, as you kind of alluded to as well, that has like a much longer tail. I think it's the longest running Nicktoon until SpongeBob like eventually overtakes it. And, you know, SpongeBob has like lapped it twice at this point. It's like crazy.
Ugh, yeah. Yeah, nothing will stop SpongeBob.
Genuinely. I was seeing someone was sharing on Twitter the other day, like the Nicktoons channel, or one of the Nick like spin-off channels in the US. It's just genuinely the entire schedule is SpongeBob, just back to back all day, every day. I mean, we might have some lamenting on like kind of where kids' animation is at the moment, but it's in a rough spot. Like Cartoon Network aren't particularly doing much better at the moment. It's like the Teen Titans Go avalanche has been kind of emblematic of where Cartoon Network has been at for the last like 5+ years, It's scary.
The animation industry is just ebbs and flows, and we can only hope that at the moment we're in an ebb, and that means we're coming up to a flow again. That's all we can hope.
I've got my fingers crossed. It's like, I've seen good, people do love to like big up like indie animation in particular, and sort of, I think people have been waiting for internet animators to kind of break through in a big way, and like Smiling Friends has been a big part of that. It's like, that's really broken through. And I know Zach and Michael Cusack have said they want to do some kind of Smiling Friends game. I would love to see what that would be like.
Oh my God, make it VR, please.
Yeah, VR feels natural given where the Rick and Morty games went. And that's like what Squanch games were doing. I kind of
VR,
love to
just,
see...
I want to see VR Charlie.
Front-facing.
More than anything.
Front-facing Alan.
Yes. God.
Like, I think... I saw someone suggest it, where I'd kind of love them to go would be like kind of a LucasArts style like point and click.
Ooh.
With like just sort of kind of obtuse puzzles, because I feel like that's some of the best episodes of the show are where they just kind of blunder into a solution. It's like, it's not even directly through what Pim and Charlie have done. It's just sort of happenstance.
Oh, point and click would be fantastic. Like a
like
a Sam and Max style, where there's just loads of shit to click. Oh, that would work so well though.
Yeah,
I still like want those... the VR. I want both of these things.
Both, 2K.
Yeah, exactly. They need to do a VR title.
Yeah.
And they also need to do a point and click. Those are like the two genres.
And they need to do a games as a service game, first and foremost. That needs to be.
Of course. Yeah.
Anyway, that was a huge sidetrack, but either way.
Well, I mean, it's still animation, so it's like tangentially related.
No, absolutely.
We can't help it. We're both super animation nerds, so it's gonna happen, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. But yeah, like I feel like indie animation is pushing in a positive direction at the moment, and it is kind of reminiscent of this like creator driven push that Nick were following in the early 90s. And again, Ren and Stimpy is like the poster child of that. So to kind of prepare for this episode, I decided to do a bit of an investigation because Ren and Stimpy was something I never really saw on like first go around. It's something I always heard referred to, right? Like every time, like even in like adult animation or like again SpongeBob, people talk about like Ren and Stimpy close-ups and stuff like that. And I'd always be like, what is Ren and Stimpy? Like, what is this? And like, how is it like so influential? How is it such a cornerstone? But like, it completely like passed me by. And about a decade ago, I was like, right, I'm going to go on a legally sanctioned website. I'm going to go on kisscartoon123 .org.biz.
Yeah, the legal home of Ren and Stimpy.
Yes. And I'm going to sit down and I'm actually going to like watch these and like try and understand where the influence is. And it's strange. You can definitely feel the sort of the indie pull to it. Because we watched a few episodes while I was at yours as well, because I kind of wanted to get you on board with like the show's general vibe. Because I don't know if you had any kind of experience of Ren and Stimpy before.
Maybe in passing. Don't think I ever... Like, I have such vague memories of seeing that show. It definitely didn't grab hold of me the same way Rugrats did, probably because I think it was more aimed at a slightly older kids audience. And like I say, around that period, I was 5 or 6, so I don't think I was the intended audience for Ren and Stimpy. That strikes me as more of a 10 to 12 kind of range. At least, I feel like there's an older barrier of entry for that one, and in order to appreciate it.
It's a bit more, like, cynical, it's a bit more, like, rebellious. Like, Rugrats is still, like, subversive, the writing's incredibly fun, especially when you pay attention to, like, the parents' conversations.
Oh my god, I've been... I'm very excited. Not to go into this too early, but I have been... watching the hell out of Rugrats for a bit.
But like when I first like started watching Ren and Stimpy, the thing that hit me was like the pacing is really like eclectic, and I don't just mean that in terms of it being fast paced. I mean that it's quite uneven, and when you sort of learn about the production history of it, it starts to make a bit more sense. So it's like, you know, I watched all these episodes like a decade ago, I obsessed over them, I started drawing like the style of the show. I really enjoyed the sort of, I mean, like Ren is like a living line of action and Stimpy is like a big sack of custard, so they're just like, they're fantastic to draw.
So like natural to draw, so basically loose.
You really want to draw Ren always like looming over Stimpy, threatening him, Stimpy being beaten about. It's like, yeah, both just so fun to draw, so fun to act. And the funny thing I sort of picked up through my research, though, is that even though they didn't have a model sheet, they were still quite, like, particular about the way they're drawn and the way they're depicted, which is where you kind of feel the sort of production issues of the show kind of kick in. So in researching for this segment, I picked up Sick Little Monkeys, which is the sort of unauthorized, like, Ren and Stimpy oral history by Thad Komorowski. He's guested on like What a Cartoon and Talking Simpsons and stuff, so I'd like kind of been in his orbit before. He's like an animation historian. This is sort of like one of his big works. I was reading the 2017 edition, I believe, so there were like a few sort of like corrections and updates and stuff, but mostly the same as the original text. And it was a really interesting history because it's a lot of stuff that I like kind of knew the bones of, and it's a lot of stuff that you can kind of sense through watching the episodes. But when you properly get an idea of like just how chaotic the production of the show was, it really explains so much about it. The biggest thing that kind of hit me is that I believe they were commissioned for a 6-episode season to start with. And it took forever. I think they delivered like the first 2 episodes more or less on time. And then like as time went on, it was like, episode 3 kind of misses the mark by a few weeks, then episode 4 misses by a few weeks more, and then by the time they get to episode 6, it's basically been delayed like a year. And Nick are kind of embarrassed by this because Rugrats, meanwhile, I think does a 13-episode season, fairly standard to start with. Doug, much the same. They're able to put out new episodes of that. Ren and Stimpy, they're constantly having to like rerun the same two or three episodes over and over and then be like, oh, you know, stay tuned, kids. In a couple of months, there'll be a whole new episode, like something new to obsess over. And it's difficult to kind of judge because Ren and Stimpy's definitely being produced to a different standard than Rugrats and Doug, where those are both, again, those are shows that have model sheets, maybe more function in terms of how like the animation studio and stuff is set up.
Yeah, from what I tell from watching Rugrats, certainly the early seasons, it's not as loose, I would say, and not as well animated, for example, as Ren and Stimpy can be.
Yeah. Part of where you see it as well is that John Kay's whole deal is that Ralph Bakshi's kind of his auteur and his like his mentor rather rather than auteur. Mm. And Ralph Bakshi's work, obviously through Fritz the Cat and stuff like that, is again quite dysfunctional. Ralph Bakshi's quite known for having quite big arguments with people. If you've ever seen Cool World, that is like an absolute mess of a film. It's like kind of trying to be like a more noir version of Roger Rabbit, but it's so confused on like the rules of the world and like how things are supposed to work, and also there's just like shit happening constantly all the time. It's like it's both like incredibly boring and incredibly like visually overstimulating. Like it's fascinating. If you ever get the chance to watch it, it's like a fascinating failure in my eyes. But yeah, the two of them work together in quite a dysfunctional relationship from the sounds of things. And then, you know, Ren and Stimpy goes on. It continues to have a dysfunctional production schedule. To sort of cut a long story short, they get about midway through season two. John Kay gets fired because they go massively over budget. Episodes keep getting delayed. There's also other stuff going on, which has been talked about.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, the show does continue on for a while. But again, as I say, it's like, in addition to everything else, John Kay also like gets kind of in bed with like the animation press. He sort of, and this was the thing that was really interesting to me when I originally researched Ren and Stimpy while I was studying animation in the same class as you, the biggest sources that kept coming up were these magazines that were like Cartoon Kingdom, Animation World Network, stuff like that. And you're reading through it and you're like, man, this is really bashing like the new episodes, like the at the time new episodes of Ren and Stimpy. It's like, oh, Games Animation, who are the guys that took over, like it's all soulless. You know, they're just doing it off the script like The Simpsons, blah, blah, blah. And then, you know, you kind of, I found out a few years after that, that was actually all like ghost written by John Kay. And he had this sort of, it's crazy because it's like, it sounds like you're talking about like this shadowy cabal, but it's really like just this mad
man.
Yeah, madman. Where it's like,
there's one man.
Yeah. And the thing that's always so tough about it, I don't have any bones about like condemning the guy. The behavior that went on behind the scenes, even the Me Too of it all, was just like unacceptable.
Mm-hmm.
But you can kind of see how people are captivated by like the artistry. And again, when you've gone through such a bad drought in the 80s, it's kind of like, I kind of get it. But it's like, it's difficult to talk about, but it's like, it's one of the most like conflicting sort of art versus the artist kind of things I've confronted. I think in my time, like sort of looking at animation. Anyway,
the nice thing about animation ultimately is that it's never one person.
No.
At least so rarely. If it's syndicated like this, it is not one person.
No.
So you don't have to fully be supporting one artist by enjoying a property. You can still condemn the actions of that one guy.
Yeah.
While still enjoying the work of the many other people who worked on the property.
Yeah, exactly. And it's like, I mean, kind of funnily enough, like one of the things that seemed to be one of the biggest issues in production was that John Kay was just trying to get his hands on everything and do everything. And it's like, you're supposed to be like a producer and a director. Like, you can't be the board artist and the layout artist and the in-betweener and the color guy.
You have to pick. Yeah. You have to choose something.
Exactly.
Like, as the producer and the director, you have a say in these things, but you can't do them all. Like, the whole point of being in charge is that you delegate.
Yeah. And it's like, the guy also gets like so many chances after Ren and Stimpy to kind of turn it around. It's like so many of them are such monumental backfires. And every time he's always like, oh, there was network meddling, or I didn't have the right team. People didn't believe in it.
It was everyone else's fault. It wasn't me.
Yeah. And it's like,
I was tricked into all these things.
One of the particular low points in the deer is they kind of revive Ren and Stimpy under something called Adult Party Cartoon, which is like when Spike TV starts, which is like the men's network. They're like, oh, we're going to do this raunchy animation block. It premieres alongside a show called Stripperella, which Stan Lee is involved in some weird, like, producer. It's like Stan Lee's Stripperella, but it's like he just sort of, like, put a rubber stamp on it. And, again, baffling, really hard to find, like, any footage of that show because nobody wanted to tape it when it was on the
fucking
air.
Fucking lost media again. That would have been something I could have cited as my lesbian origins, really. Damn it.
Yeah. Like, Adult Party Cartoon is just, like, ridiculously uneven. I think I didn't kind of subject myself to watching it, but I know some of the episodes are just like ridiculously long for what they are, and then some of them are like way under time and they have to kind of put in bits of filler. Again, like from the episodes we watch, you could definitely see like there's parts where it's like, look, this could be a good story, but you're spending way too long in the wrong parts of it. You're like spending like 2 minutes just like being like, wouldn't it be funny if we could just animate Stimpy crying in all these different ways? And it's like, I guess, but like, do you want to just blow that all in like one episode, like completely stop the story so that like he could like fully dehydrate himself and dry himself out and then soak it up like a rug and then like spit
and also
out
like
eyes
and also let's not forget the budget, just completely blow that on one animation.
Like doing it all on once, doing this crazy fluid effect. It's like, again, it's like on the one hand, the anarchic stick it to the man part of you is like, ha, it's really funny that Paramount and Viacom and Nickelodeon are bankrolling this. But on the other hand, you're just like, oh my God, this sucks. This is like agony to sit through. I remember at the point where I was getting into the show like a decade ago, and by the way, listener, we will talk about the games. Spoiler alert, there's not a huge amount to talk about, but like, I'm making a greater point here, bear with me. We get to Hands Without Labels, which was still in production at the time that I was like getting into this originally. And this was something that, it was a very early Kickstarter project that came about in like 2012. So this is like, I don't know if this is around the time of like, you know, like Mighty Number 9, a little bit before Shovel Knight, you know, that really early swell where like Kickstarter just started, the Ouya.
Indivisible, yes. I think was around then as well, which is my personal fucking burden to bear.
Oh God, yeah. That like early honeymoon period where it was like, oh cool, there's this great way for independents to like get funding, not have to worry about venture capitalists, etc. etc. The traditional system, before we hit the sort of doldrums of like endless delays and then half-baked products and then
I just remembered Omori as well, that came around Omori, then as well.
I mean, there's good stuff that came out of it, like again Shovel Knight, but
yeah, for sure. And Omori, once it did come out, was like, it's great once although that's another one where you have to start overlooking the artist.
Yeah, for sure.
Which maybe we'll cover at some point. We'll see how that goes.
If you've got something to say about Omori, we can definitely talk about it at some point.
I was a Kickstarter backer, so I have a lot of insight.
I mean, so many Kickstarter stories are so interesting to follow in that way, because it's like, we're given this like unparalleled access to like development history, but it is a lot of stuff where you're like, okay, maybe I mean, you know, people have had issues with when games get announced too early.
Yeah.
And they don't have much to show. Mm-hmm. Prime example that like immediately comes to mind for me is Perfect Dark, the big Xbox game that they announced at the end of 2020, I think. And then we only just got another trailer last month.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, so, yeah, tangent
cans,
again.
Yeah, cans about yeah, again, setting a scene.
Yep.
Cans About Labels is this Kickstarter that John Kay's wanting to do, and he's like, he's got this character, George Licker, that he sort of wrestled away, and he's like, oh yeah, I want to do this thing about my childhood where I'm growing up and we had to eat food out of cans without labels because it was like the discount stuff. At the time that I'm originally getting into Ren and Stimpy, it's been like 3 years, and it's like, this was meant to be like a 10, 11 minute short, like a sort of, you know, like Golden Age Looney Tunes sort of style thing, mm-hmm. like a quick gag cartoon. Like, where is it? And it takes another like 4 years after that and a lot of sort of like blank space where nothing's happening and lots of questions, lots of obviously understandably angry people. Mm-hmm. And eventually the short comes out and it's like, oh my God, yeah, you can tell that this took like 7 or 8 years to make because it's an absolute mess. It's, oh my God. Again, if you haven't ever seen Cans About Labels, it's fascinating. It's like this guy like grappling with like, every like fad of the week, he's like trying to figure out flash tweening. There's like random 3D elements. You can tell the animation staff is like constantly changing.
Oh, no.
It's all the pitfalls of like some of the worst of like Ren and Stimpy.
Oh man, I may have to check that out.
it's again, it's an interesting garbage.
Morbid line. Curiosity is really creeping in right now.
Yeah. Which again brings us to the, as you'll probably see, quite understandably sidelined part of my segment where I actually talk about the games. This is something where I will admit on mic the folly of me being like, oh, this would be a really fun subject to research, and then the games being kind of an afterthought to the point where I boot up the games and I'm like, oh, these are just there's like barely anything here. Mm-hmm. But I will give a sort of running tour. I think the closest thing that I can kind of draw between the cartoon and the games is just that unevenness and that sort of just not really understanding like what they want to do with it. Mm. The most sort of common theme between them is that they tend to be like every level is going to be like a different episode. And they achieve this to varying degrees of mediocrity to outright failure. The first sort of game is like Buckaroos, which is on the NES and the SNES. They both start out with completely different levels. The NES version starts with like one set in sort of the Space Cadet thing, which is like a recurring sort of gag. They're sort of making fun of these like 50s space operas.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to guide Stimpy across the lab to get into like a matter transporter, but it's got this weird sort of A Boy and His Blob style puzzle solving where you've got to like pick up different items. You've got to pick up like the socks and the spring and like, I think there's like stinky cheese or whatever. And then you've got to like figure out what they do, figure out how they interact with the environment, trial and error it, like kind of jankily get Ren to walk into the proper place. It like feels like you're programming in just like a dark room where you can't see the keyboard, you can't see the screen, you're just like blindly hitting keys trying to figure out like what to do. It's an incredibly bad first impression. Oh. And it doesn't get much better from there. Then they do Stimpy's Invention on the Mega Drive. This is a weird sort of side-scrolling game. It kind of reminds me of the Beavis and Butthead game that they do later.
Mm-hmm.
You're just sort of walking through this abstract nightmare realm. It's a bit like Bart's Nightmare as well, where it's sort of like supposed to be suburbia, but it's this weird, like, twisted version of it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, again, the priorities are kind of all in the wrong places. It's like, I'm pressing every button. Because I don't have the manual or anything. I do look at the manual to try and figure out if it elucidates on anything. It spends half of it just, like, making, like, lame gags. And it's like, the thing that's kind of difficult, and the thing I will kind of give them some praise for, is that it's kind of clear that the guys working on this game do have knowledge of the cartoon, at least. Like, they do enjoy... You can see that they're watching this and they're like, oh, this will be really fun to sprite, right? Like, it'll be really fun to make all these wacky expressions and stuff. but I don't think they were kind of given enough time to actually think through the game design part of it. And that's where the similarities to the show come in for me. It's like, in the same way some episodes of Ren and Stimpy absolutely failed to have like story structure, some of the Ren and Stimpy games just fail to be games, to like prioritize game design tenets. Like Stimpy's invention, I'm trying to remember off the top of my head. I swear one of the buttons on the pad just literally makes Ren go, "You idiot," which probably used like an eighth of the cartridge. Like, my priorities in the entirely wrong place.
Mm-hmm.
But like, that was just the priority they had. That was what the appeal of the series was. So I guess they went for that. Then they do Vidiots for the SNES and the Game Boy. That's very similar to Buckaroos, where again, it's a bunch of like vignettes. This one's only like 3 stages long. I got through stage 1, which was based off I forget what the specific episode is, but it's the one where Ren dresses up as a mouse and then Stimpy goes over to be like the mouse catcher, to be like the family cat or whatever. It has that extensive sequence where he's like chewing on Ren for like 2 minutes. Which I might have been one of the segments you were talking about earlier.
Mm-hmm.
They kind of turn that into a stage, which is interesting, at least. It's like you're running around first as Ren, and again, it's kind of mindless. You're like knocking shit off the walls. You're kind of like, okay, is this a like collect all the things kind of platformer? Is this a get to the end of the stage platformer? Or is this a I have a hidden objective to do and then I have to get to the end kind of platformer? It's never entirely clear. Then there's like a whole level where you're inside the mouth, but then if you touch certain teeth, then the entire mouth closes and it's just like instant death. It's like, it's just like inscrutable. And then they kind of get to Fire Dogs, which is a game on the SNES that's based entirely off one segment, or one episode rather, Fire Dogs. Which is one of the more famous ones. It's the one where they paint themselves to look like Dalmatians and they join the Fire Brigade. A very aimless cartoon, though. Like, halfway through, it's just, like, trampoline gags.
Yeah.
And the game doesn't really know what to do, either. It's like, you start out, and they very faithfully recreated the sort of library music they use. Ren and Stimpy loves using this sort of stock library music. But you're just wandering around the fire station, going up and down the different floors. I think you're playing as Stimpy, which is a rare one. Usually you're just Ren and Stimpy's like a power-up or whatever, or player two. But yeah, it just has all these weird mechanics that, again, they don't fully explain. I'm looking through the scan of the manual, desperately trying to figure out like what the hell I'm supposed to be doing. And then I just resign myself to the fact that it's like, this just doesn't feel fun. And that's kind of...
Yeah, it's just
kind of where
it's just anti-fun by the sound of things.
Yeah.
Homework.
Yeah, exactly. It felt like homework to me as well. More so than like reading a book and like writing notes based off that. Like actually playing the games felt like some sort of cruel inverse.
Never has this podcast felt more like homework.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah, the last game that they kind of do is Time Warp on the SNES, which is kind of getting at it because it's more of a beat 'em up. And when I saw that was what the style of gameplay they were going for was, I was like, oh, that's actually good. That like works for the slapstick, right? Like,
yep,
you're running
yep.
around as Ren, you pick Stimpy up, you throw him at things, you slap him at things.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Where this one falls down is the bizarre decision in the first stage to have these fences you have to keep going through, and they plaster these big annoying flashing arrows that are like, hit here, don't hit here. You have to like hit a specific part of the fence to go through it, and if you hit the wrong part, you get hit, and Ren screams, but there's no like health bar or anything, so it's like I don't know if that just stunned me or did that hurt me, like what did that do. You have to like line yourself up to the specific pixel or the fence that it wants you to hit. It then it will let you through, and it just repeats this gimmick like 7 or 8 times in the level. And then you eventually get to the boss of the level, which is just a big bulldog, and he just immediately chews you up and you just die one hit. And that's it.
No!
You just melt into the pavement and then you got to do it all again. And I just, at this point, head in my hands, I'm just like, there's nothing to redeem these. There's nothing of interest here. The most interesting thing I can do is frame it in the same way that the show's uneven and has, but still has charm. But I mean, you know, that makes it sound like I don't like the show. And I love the show. I love Ren and Stimpy, even when it is just absolutely, like, actively hostile to your attention. I think it's still interesting, but these are just, like...
unforgivable.
Yeah, soggy cardboard. It's like, you're just, you can feel the games falling apart in your hands as well.
Yeah.
And the fact that they get so close to something with Time Warp, that, again, a beat-em-up is, like, perfect for Ren and Stimpy.
Mm-hmm.
If they'd have got Konami in on it and they'd done something like The Turtles or The Simpsons,
that would have been so good.
There could have been something really fun there. I mean, you know, Dot Emu and those guys have been doing sort of throwback, like they did a throwback Turtles game a bit ago. Beat-em-ups in general are kind of coming back, like Streets of Rage 4 that came out a few years ago, really loved that game. Double Dragon Neon, people really love. River City Girls. And, you know, they're doing the reboot show, which people are kind of split on. It seems like it's a little bit more writer-driven than artist-driven, which was the same issue people had with the Animaniacs reboot. Jury's still out on if it's, you know, like, I think one or two episodes leaked. We don't know if any of the other episodes are going to be any better. It's like, it's kind of nail-gnashing, you know? Because I do want this show to come back in, like, a big style, but it is also, like, at the same time, emblematic of, like, underwhelming returns for these kind of things.
Yeah.
As we said with the animation industry, it's like, yeah, it feels like a lot of old bodies are being dredged up and puppeted around.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, hard to know where to be enthusiastic.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, that was my journey through Ren and Stimpy. Come back after the break for some Rugrats exposé.
Hello, it's me leading this time, I guess. An unusual flavor. So, after hearing the many trials and tribulations of poor Sam, he may now rest. In the same way David is. He's still here. But I shall be leading this next segment. So, I spent my sort of portion of this dealing with the Rugrats games.
You went to the baby zone.
I was in the
angry baby zone. You and you were the serene baby standing there.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah. There were moments, but mostly, yeah, it was pretty straightforward. I knew what my direction was vaguely going to be. So, like I said earlier, the reboot for Rugrats, it happened right around when I was 5 or 6.
Yeah.
So I got very, very into Rugrats because it was one of the main cartoons that would be on the television at the time. Yeah. I did own all sorts of merch and, like, media. I had VHSs, toys, anything that as a child I could get my hands on or persuade my parents to get me, I had. I was a massive Rugrats fan. So, inevitably, I got into the games eventually. And that is where my segment kind of is going to sort of follow is especially the PlayStation 1 games. I spent a lot of time with those.
And I will say, actually, the thing that specifically did also make me go for Ren and Stimpy is because of the way the star burned on that thing. They stopped making those games around about the SNES era, but that's when the Rugrats games kind of start. It's like they have a couple sort of 8-bit adjacent games on the Game Boy, but then it's like the 3D games are really where Rugrats kind of make their nest. So as rats do, they made the Rat King around the PlayStation 1.
They sure did. So whilst I'm going to focus on the PS1 games, I do briefly have to acknowledge that I think my first Rugrats game may have ended up being the Game Boy Color movie tie-in. Because the Game Boy Color was the first console I actually owned. So by extension, I'm fairly certain that would have been the first one I played. In all honesty, that game doesn't have a huge amount of meat on its bones. I think you did play a bit of it, Sam. It's essentially just a side scroller collectathon type affair. You're just going through the levels collecting things, if I remember correctly. I didn't replay it for the pod.
I played a little bit of that game and a little bit of Search for Reptar, which you'll get onto. The one commonality I saw between them was the baby control, where Tommy does feel very top heavy. Obviously, they're all walking around these spindly little necks and these giant heads.
If there's one thing they nailed with these games, it is making the babies feel inordinately heavy.
It's like Search for Reptar, from what I played of it, borders on like tank controls.
You'd have no idea about the other games then.
I played a little bit of that movie game just for the sake of research. I found out it was, I mean, the credits in the game say it up front, but it is one of those games that they converted it from the black and white Game Boy to the Game Boy Color. And there are sort of, there's difference in specs between the two, because the Game Boy Color, it's a small upgrade, but the biggest thing beyond the color palette is that they like double the RAM, which means a lot of games are able to do like more calculations more quickly. They can store more things in memory, so generally games perform a lot better. Like if you compare like sort of Wario Land 2 and Wario Land 3, it's like Wario Land 3 is like much smoother animations, bigger levels, stuff like that. But there are quite a few early Game Boy Color games where they sort of just directly transpose the sort of assembly language stuff over from the Game Boy version, which makes them feel quite sluggish on the color. And you definitely feel that in this game. It's like, again, in addition to the controls already being quite heavy and the frame rate not being on the most stable side, it's like, it does just feel slower and like floaty, but also it like oddly heavy. I think that's the best way of describing it, really.
I remember that game decently well. In all honesty, I don't think I've ever really felt a need to go back to it since I was a kid. And even now, I was curious, and then I saw Sam play it for maybe 30 seconds and went, cool, I got my fill. Neat.
It was the same for the Paris movie game, where I booted that up and I was jump scared by the fact that it was a mini game collection rather than a platformer, and the first thing is like a whack-a-mole game with like somehow awful controls, even though it's like it should just be you press the button and it snaps to the hole, but it's like the perspectives are really weird. And again, it feels weirdly slow. It's not a good time. Not much to say on those.
Yeah, we're probably gonna skip out on the Game Boy games because they're better than the Ren and Stimpy ones from what I'm hearing, but they're not, there's just not a lot to say. They're serviceable, they're fine. Really interests me, and from what I was seeing, interests a lot of people nowadays, like a lot of people have gone back to this specific game, is Rugrats Search for Reptar. That specific game seems to have had a cultural impact, apparently. It's a fascinating game because it's the most faithful, I'd say, to the show.
Interesting.
Each of the levels are based on episode titles, some more accurately than others, I will say. But but it's kind of wild playing that one and then going on to the others. But I'll get to that.
Yeah.
Search for Reptar, interestingly enough, is also one of the better selling PS1 games?
Yes, I was seeing this.
Yeah, it was third best in the first 2 weeks of release when it came out. Like, it was it was a number 3 bestseller.
And this is 1998. This is, like, one of the canonical, like, gaming years. Mm-hmm. You know, this is one of those ones people are like, what's the best games year? Is it 98? Is it 2001? Is it 04?
Yeah.
This is what I've really enjoyed about this pod in particular is, like, we examine the licensed game stuff, not just because it's funny and it's nostalgic and stuff, and it gives us a chance to do, like, wider media stuff. But I think a lot of people do get a bit, like, snooty about being like, oh, it only counts if it's, like, if it's an original to games IP. But I think looking at the commercial bigger picture, you can't really understate, like, when these cross-media properties come
you
in and they have the success they do.
You can't ignore it. And the thing is, there's a certain amount of schlock out there that was just shoved out to be a tie-in. But then there's things like this specific game that really feels like a labor of love that just had to be rushed. I found evidence of that.
Ooh, okay.
Which I'm super excited to share. But yeah, so this game bizarrely is a PS1 bestseller. It later got re-released as, like, part of the greatest hits collections that they used
Makes
to do.
Sense, yeah.
Sold nearly 1.5 million copies in the US, apparently. Like,
yeah, wow.
Absolutely wild to think of Rugrats as a juggernaut of the PS1. Mm. But that just kind of shows where the property was at the time, I suppose.
Mm.
It was kind of a tie-in with the first movie, but not really.
Yeah.
They clearly tried to line up the release of it with around about the first movie. Because I think the first movie, I don't have the exact date on that right now. That was like 98-99.
It was close, yeah.
This came out 98-99 as well.
Interesting. I think it's the same weekend as Ocarina of Time as well.
Yes, yes, it was. It was 98, yeah.
Yeah, so, no, I'm seeing here November 98, so it was genuinely, the movie would have come out and then the game came out like a week later.
Yeah, so bizarrely, like, this came out around the same time as the movie, but clearly they just decided, rather than going with the movie tie-in sort of thing with this one, they were like, no, we're just gonna go with the source material, the original source material, because there's more to pull from.
Yeah.
And
makes sense.
Yeah, so yeah, not only is this like a really massively popular game, but it was also incredibly well marketed. It had a multi-million dollar marketing campaign, only beaten by Ocarina of Time.
Yeah.
Which is bizarre, because that means this is the best marketed game of the PS1 at that time. Like, that's an insane statement to make.
Yeah.
The most annoying thing is there's references to this, but finding the actual material was a headache. I couldn't find very much at all. The best I could find was this one PS1 postcard with Tommy on it that I'm gonna link to Sam right now just so that he can see it.
Right.
It gives an idea, I suppose, of the sort of thing that they were producing, but it's strange.
Yeah. I will say I do enjoy the listing on this postcard that you've sent me that specifically states it's unposted. like it's a part of the minting like it's like, oh no, nobody's ever posted this. But then it means, like, does the condition degrade once they send it off to you, or are they gonna write your address on the back of the postcard and post it that way and soil it forever?
That would be fucking
so good. And then it's just, dear buyer, sorry I ruined the value of this. Smiley face.
Oh, I screwed it up.
I'm trying to erase it. Help.
But I wrote it in Biro. Help me.
Yeah.
So yeah.
Yeah, big marketing.
Big marketing. Box. I wish I could have found more.
Yeah.
Sadly, that was kind of the extent of what I could find, was a single postcard and a flyer for a sweepstakes.
Yeah. There's an IGN article that says they're doing some kind of guerrilla marketing by putting it on Rugrats fruit snacks boxes, which the Wikipedia article also is like, this is important. This is big news in the world of Rugrats fruit snacks. It's cross-media.
So I kind of started, I mean, the first place I started with research for this was obviously playing the game.
Yeah.
It is for sure the most enjoyable of all the games I played.
Yeah.
By far, the whole premise of the game, as many people have covered, is that Tommy is trying to find the puzzle pieces of his Reptar puzzle.
Yeah.
There's 15 pieces in total, and there's various levels you can go into to find it, but there's also various Reptar bars strewn around the levels that you can collect, and that will also eventually give you a puzzle piece. The levels are all, they're varying degrees of fun, I would say, but none of them are, like, terrible. They're all, honestly, the novelty of being able to go around the 2D home of the Rugrats in a 3D space is... that has merit in itself for the sort of intended audience.
I mean, the thing that's, I suppose to kind of briefly like sidebar, the thing that's fascinating about Rugrats' visual design is that they're so lumpy. And it's like, so that's something Klasky Csupo really embrace in all their shows.
Oh yeah.
Seeing these guys in 3D is like a trip.
Oh, it's nightmarish.
The way their mouths animate in particular, the way it dominates like half of their face. Uh-huh. It's like...
No, that for sure. It is not something that I feel like translated particularly well to 3D, but there is a novelty to it.
Yeah.
And the fact that they did it that is...
Yeah.
That's cool. You know, it's neat. Yeah. And the first thing that kind of struck me when I started this game was I felt immediately unnerved by the space. Like, I don't know why, as a 30-year-old, I was being made unnerved by this space, but I immediately felt a little anxious.
Yeah.
I think it's because it's very reminiscent of a liminal space. It's very empty. Yeah. It's just not a lot going on. There's no one else in it.
Yeah, from the bit I played, it was like the camera's pulled quite close to you, so it's, and the focal range is quite small. So I think it kind of creates the idea of, like, you know, baby's eye view. It makes the living room seem huge. But it is like, yeah, don't you like walk around into like bits of mist and then you like interact with them and then it's like, go to Ice Cream Mountain or whatever, and then it's like
it's you interact with various pieces around house.
Okay, gotcha.
Yes, there's like an umbrella, and that one leads to Chucky's glasses level. Where you play as Chucky.
It's like you hold the object, you interact with its soul, and then it flashes through to you. You have flashbacks.
And you flashback, yes, exactly. We're flashing back through Tommy's life.
Yeah.
Or in one case, from Tommy through to Spike. Yeah, no, there's a level you play Spike. It's the Seven Voyages of Cynthia, where...
Oh my god.
Which, in the episode itself, it's when the kids sort of play with Cynthia while Angelica's distracted by something else.
Yeah.
They're playing with a boat in this sort of stream that their dads are making while they're washing down a car or a boat. It was a boat.
Yeah.
They were washing down their sort of boat. The kids make their own little sort of boat out of a fence post and a peace sign. And then they're like, oh, we need a captain. And they go get Cynthia. And Cynthia immediately goes through the bars of the bottom of the garden and ends up going on a whole adventure through the sewage system of America.
Yeah.
And in that same episode, Angelica is trying to find a husband for Cynthia to marry.
Yeah.
She tries to get Spike to do it. Spike doesn't want to. And so she pushes him out of the garden and like through a broken fence post.
Yeah.
And then he goes on his own adventure through this sort of garbage system of America and ends up in the same place as Cynthia.
Yeah.
In the actual game, that translates to Angelica telling Spike to go get Cynthia, and then you play as Spike jumping through the sewage system and getting Cynthia. But so it's that kind of thing where it's a loose interpretation of the episodes. Ice Cream Mountain is mini golf, where you're just playing through sort of a very cursory mini golf set, except from the single level which has a pyramid in it.
Yeah.
That for some reason there's a whole maze within.
Whoa.
So the hole itself, very rudimentary, four par,
yeah,
whatever. You wander off and investigate this pyramid, and you can fully enter it as Angelica.
Yeah.
And you go down through, and it is a whole bizarre maze that you can kind of hear weird mechanical sounds in.
Ooh.
And so you're going through, and there's loads of Reptar bars in there, so there's like an incentive to kind of go through.
Okay.
But it's so easy to get lost.
Yeah.
And eventually, if you go into sort of the middle of the maze, you will encounter a mummified version of the Mr. Friend doll that appears in the in the game multiple times.
Right.
He doesn't do any damage to you within that level, but as a child, that is an incredibly unnerving and upsetting thing to just find.
Yeah.
Because you assume you're going to take damage from him. And so then you're panically trying to get out of the maze you've gotten yourself into.
Yeah.
And very genuinely, it did actually take me a couple of minutes to find my way back out of the maze as an adult.
Yeah.
So I have no idea what the inclusion of that was about, but yeah, they, for some reason, in this specific mini golf level, they include this whole other just extra. There's no reason for it besides adventuring.
Yeah, stuff like that. I always wonder if it's like, maybe they had another prototype in development and it was like,
well,
oh, okay, it got rolled in. Do go on. It sounds like you have the scoop.
Well, so literally, I have found through searches, I finally apparently typed in the correct search requirements to find the original design notes of the Rugrats Search for Reptar game.
Okay.
And it is a wild read, to be honest. So the game that came out, from what I'm telling from this design document, they did this game in a year because the design document is dated 97. So
yep,
there is a lot that was clearly cut.
Yeah.
So Search for Reptar, it's a fine game. It's really, it's like a serviceable game.
Yeah.
There's all these levels, they're enjoyable enough, but the original concept for this game, essentially what they originally concepted was like a cooperative multi-character experience where there were multiple difficulty levels where you would play as just Tommy if it was the easy mode.
Yeah.
Tommy and Chucky if it was the sort of medium mode, and then all four babies if it was the hard mode.
Right.
And you'd have to get all four babies through the level.
Yeah.
Or rather, all babies that you were playing as through the level.
Yeah.
So they kind of intended it to be a sort of more open world affair, I think, or a more like a more adventure based affair than it ended up being.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
I'm seeing the gears turning. Yeah.
Uh-huh. So I wonder if it was a holdover from that.
I think you're onto something there.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So the pyramid kind of makes more sense once you realize or read about that.
Yeah.
Because yeah, they initially wanted there to be, yes, there was a hub, but there were like quests, referenced adventures, games. They wanted to have like off-site episodes, essentially. So I don't know if you'd maybe leave the hub and then enter like a level select screen or something. There's like a whole load of episodes that they never managed to put in, like an episode just called Naked Tommy, which you just run
around, okay,
where you just run around naked as Tommy, apparently. There's like give that Spike a bone, where you have to snatch a T-Rex bone for Spike. So
right,
like there is some absolutely insane ideas for levels that I'm now lamenting don't exist, because holy shit, I really wish they'd had 3 years to work on this thing rather than one, because the stuff in this design document is so fascinating to me.
You'll definitely have to send that along to me, so I can, if I can pop it into the description, I definitely will, because I want to have a read for it for sure.
Yes, I have it copy pasted and it has now been sent to you, because anyone who has any interest in the behind the scenes of this game, this is such a window into it.
I think that's always something interesting to think about in the context of game development. Is it's quite easy to lament the final product or to look at like what could have been or you know, what it isn't. But like, I mean, people always say it about like creative stuff in general, but especially with games, it's like, it's crazy that like anything gets finished, you know? Like a lot of people say in like creative stuff, it's like, you never really finish something, you just stop working on it.
Uh-huh.
That was definitely how I felt like researching my segment to tie it back to that as well. But it's like, with stuff like this, it's like, it's kind of a miracle the game holds together as well as it does, still works in the way it does when it had these like grand ambitions that they had to pare back. I always find stories like that really interesting games. Yeah. So that's really cool that you were able to find that.
Yeah, absolutely bizarre. I was so enamored earlier reading this, where it was just reading all these lofty goals and thinking, oh man, what a shame that they clearly didn't have the time they thought they had or the budget they thought they had.
Yeah.
And had to, from, I mean, given this design draft is from 97, they essentially at most probably had a year to a year and a half to work on this game. So so what they achieved in that year is pretty impressive when you put it into that perspective. Like,
yeah, I'll say
it's just these lofty goals for this tie-in game is, it's kind of heartwarming, you know.
Yeah.
And they're so, the language they use in this is so fascinating and so lovely as well. Like they're talking about how Rugrats is a sophisticated show for today's sophisticated children, and I just love it. I'm so in love with that take. It's fantastic. It feels like they get it, you know, like they actually do care about what they're making.
I love that whenever you feel that. But then there's also like that kind of batshit, like, oh, I want to make my dream game, but I'm going to like Trojan horse it under, like, I've got this big budget for this license thing. I'm going to Trojan horse in my idea for like my dream game in underneath it.
For sure. That is like so what this felt like.
Yeah.
And the thing is their concept definitely feels very in line with Rugrats itself as well, because the episodes are so about the babies just going on these somewhat mundane, in like an adult perspective, but huge to them, adventures where they like will go to the next door garden or go into their parents' gym or whatever, you know, like or if they're away somewhere else, then they're going like way far away from their parents to the opposite side of the park or so, you know, like it's wild.
I think the thing I've heard like lots of like sort of readings of Rugrats, but the thing that I find especially interesting is a lot of people focus on it's baby's eye view, it's kids, it's all about them viewing the world as this big adventure and things as bigger than they are. I think the secret sauce of Rugrats is that it's like the babies are almost like more intelligent than you would expect. It's like,
absolutely, and that is what this design document is even getting at too. And like, it's like even in the second sentence here, it's like, instead of talking down to its audience, it assumes children are intelligent and discriminating viewers. I'm really glad to have read this and be like, just have the knowledge that they were very respectful of the source material. Almost, they weren't just pushing out some schlock for this one. They were like, no, we have to be true to the source material. We have to respect these kids. We have to make like this, we have to make the game that they deserve.
I suppose it's kind of going backwards a little bit. The thing that really captivated me for the little bit I did play was seeing Endspace's name invoked, because these guys would later go on to do a lot of first person shooters on the DS. They did a lot of conversions of like Call of Duty games and stuff, and those are really interesting in how they sort of crunched down the FPS experience onto the DS.
I wanted to get on to talking about Endspace because those guys were originally aerospace engineers.
Whoa, I didn't know that. That's cool. Not the only game design studio like that as well. Paradigm, who did Pilot Wing 64, they originally did like military grade
same aerospace origins stuff,
and then they transferred that into Pilot Wings.
That's were originally amazing. Aerospace engineers creating advanced military simulators, which then led to a contract for Sega working on the Model 1 and Model 2 boards.
Oh, wow. No way.
Mm-hmm. And then that progressed onto them making games for those.
Mm.
And then that progressed onto them sort of essentially becoming a gaming studio.
Yeah.
Making like... They did like Duke Nukem tie-ins. They did...
Oh, of course. Yes, yeah. That's right. They did the... people call them... what do they call them? I think they just call them like Duke Raider or whatever, because they're very Tomb Raider and how they control. But you're like, you're just sort of like waddling around. But they're really interesting games.
They did. I think it was the Babes one specifically. I can't remember
Land
the
of
full
the Babes,
title.
Yeah,
that's it. Land of the Babes.
Time to Kill as well.
Yes, they did both of those, I think.
Yeah.
So both of those, they did, like, as you say, they moved on to the DS eventually, but they, before that, the PS1 was their real sort of home. They, of course, did Search for Reptar.
A lot of Mary-Kate and Ashley games I'm seeing. That's interesting.
I noticed that too.
Yeah.
So very interesting studio. It's shame, sadly, went defunct back in like 2016.
Yeah. I remember one of the big unfortunate linchpins of that was they did something called Heroes of Ruin, which was kind of an attempt at an MMO on the 3DS. And I think Nintendo published it in Europe, at least. Oh no, Square Enix published it in the end, but it didn't quite get the right push. I remember they put out a trailer for it on the eShop and it was very internet culture coded, but even in like 2012, it was like literal dubstep impact text on the screen, like go on epic quests over 9,000. And it was like, even at, like 2012 was like peak Rage Comics era. And even then it was like, this feels like pandering, which was unfortunate. Mm-hmm. And I remember they had a big falling out about that and they said, we're not going to do any more Nintendo games. I don't remember if they do. No, they don't. I was trying to remember if they did the Call of Duty game on Vita. That was like one of the last big sort of portable FPSs I remember. And then the FPSs just weren't on 3DS in the same way that they were on the original DS. It was a really interesting fall off. But yeah, it was a shame to see them go, because I genuinely didn't know that aerospace thing. That's mad. And again, working on the Model 1 and the Model 2, those are really early 3D polygon pushing systems in the arcade. So like, wow, that ambition, like it all like really makes sense when you view it in that sort of narrative.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Yeah. So the more it's been fun doing the research for this, because it's kind of all puzzled together a little bit.
Yeah.
I too have been collecting the Rugrats Reptar pieces and assembling the puzzle.
And as you interacted with the objects, they interacted with your soul. And
they did. They did. I feel richer for it.
Yeah.
But so fascinating. There's even like in the design document as well, later on they talk about the sort of their main playable characters and then other like level specific characters, non-playable characters they wanted to include that sadly never did get included. My favorite description comes from Angelica Pickles, where they say she's tempestuous, she's tyrannical, she's three.
Brilliant. That's great.
I don't know if they got these like notes from
from the merchandising team or whatever,
or if they wrote them themselves. I don't know,
probably a bit of both.
I...
they probably had some cliff notes and they had fun with it.
These are fantastic. They're wonderful flavor text for all the characters here.
I have seen people draw parallels between Angelica's role with the babies and like great Greek legends and stuff, and like Shakespeare plays, you know.
I had such a good time reading it. And also it makes me a little sad, as you say, it's easy to lament about what wasn't made and think about, man, if only they could have had all the time that they needed for this.
I remember when they did that Bikini Bottom remake a while ago, Battle for Bikini Bottom, you know, that big 3D SpongeBob platformer that lots of people really connected with, and people got quite excited for, they were saying they were going to add all this cut content back in. There'd been this sort of whole fandom around this like Robo Squidward battle. in the end, it didn't quite come together. It was one of those things where I think sort of the idea of that lost content was more exciting than what would actually be done. Yeah,
exactly.
But yeah, it's always, looking at pre-release material, especially in this age where games were developed so quickly and plans could change so quickly. And yeah, it was the early 3D days, especially, where it felt like all the rules were being rewritten in terms of how games could be made.
Yep.
Like, it's such an interesting time to look at, for sure. Yep.
And as I say, Search for Reptar was definitely the best labor of love, I think. And then they very quickly lost said optimism, sadly, I think, because every other game that follows after just gets worse and worse, from what I could tell.
Yeah.
I played Studio Tour, which was by the same studio.
Yeah.
And that is a far more paint-by-numbers, mini-game-based experience. There's still a bunch of hub worlds, but it kind of loses that connection with the source material because it's set in this imaginary studio. Like, they go to a movie studio, and then Dill wanders off and they all follow him, and he gets trapped behind a door, and they all have to get keys to sort of save him. It's fine. It was fine. But definitely not the same labor of love. Made in the same engine. Clearly, they used some of the stuff maybe that they might have had to drop early on in the other game. And then there's, after that, we actually move away from N-Space developed games. I can't remember the name of the other studio. I wasn't as fascinated, honestly, by the other games because they weren't good.
Yeah, I know Artco Limited get involved with Totally
Artco,
Angelica.
Yep.
Yeah.
I think Artco did both, but I could be wrong. Totally Angelica was the final game. The one before that was, I think it was the latest one anyway.
Yeah. I do remember there being like a Mario Party clone on the N64, but it was like,
I didn't even look at that. I'm not going to lie.
There's so many Rugrats games in such a short period. It's like, again, they go almost the entire 2D age without doing anything. And then like, when in the movie, in the wake of the movie, it's like
there's
we
so gotta
do
many.
Everything all the time, all at once,
which is probably again why so many of them end up being mini game collections, because they're easier to make. But the Rugrats in Paris game that comes out after the other N-Space game, that one is something. That one, speaking of, I mentioned liminal spaces earlier.
Yes.
That is the true origin of liminal space, I swear. That one is haunting.
I played the N64 version of that, and that also suffers from, you, when they do an N64 version of a PS1 game, it's like you feel like everything's getting cut back. If there are any kind of cut scenes, they're like still images with text. All the sound is super compressed. All the textures are obviously like smeared to hell.
Yeah, I will say in the PS1 version, the cutscene versions of the babies look way better than they, and also just the 3D models of the babies look way better in this game.
That's funny.
But the trade-off for that is that the controls switch to tank controls. So it, like, genuine tank controls. You are rotating the babies with one stick and moving forward with the other. It's horrific, and there's no reason for it. It's an empty space. There's nothing going on.
They were really the style at the time. Like, to circle back to my opening segment, actually, Rayman 2 spent a while with tank controls as the focus, because the Ubisoft guys were like, Tomb Raider's big, Tomb Raider does tank controls, like, this is how 3D games should play.
Yep.
And, you know, the devs pointed at Mario 64 were like, no, look, like, free movement makes so much more sense, like, let us direct it based on the character, not the camera. And eventually they won out, but obviously not everyone was able to kind of win that battle.
No, and there's no reason for this, though, because you're literally, the only reason you're controlling the babies is to get from minigame to minigame, which are far too spaced apart, honestly.
Yeah, it's really weird. It reminded me a bit of I played the Ace Lightning game on GBA, and that was like running between stages, and it just had this weird overworld where you're just walking around, but it's like every door is like closing on you, and you're just like, You're just like, why didn't you just put me in the level? Like, why do I have to walk around this space that's like actively oppressive?
Yeah, like this would have, it just maybe would have worked better as just a selection screen. But I say that, and then they did that with Totally Angelica, and that was atrocious.
I only know about that game because Cat Icarus did a video on it ages ago.
Of course, it
was one of his real early videos. So he's just totally, every 5 seconds he's like, oh, I need the catchphrase for this, and he just goes totally funny and just keeps zooming in on our face.
That when I was playing, just to circle back to Rugrats in Paris, you get to pick one of the babies to play as for your duration. Lucy and I decided to choose Angelica.
Okay.
And we didn't regret the decision, because when I'd go back into the game, every time we'd be greeted with just maniacal laughter with no context.
So. Yeah, well, I remember playing as Chucky and it wasn't that different. He's like constantly going, and it's like, what is happening? It's like, did he get into the jelly beans or something? Like, he's just overstimulated.
Angelica for sure was overstimulated, because every time you go back into the main world or reload the game, she'd be going, yeah, and you'd be like, fucking,
they have to be laughing, like, or the kids won't know they're having a good time.
That's
shocking.
There's so many canned voice lines, like just constant rotation of the same four voice lines. It's terrible. And yes, Search for Reptar does do this
too. I did notice that as well,
but it's more forgivable, because you're like, well, you know, it's a decent game and there's got to be trade-offs somewhere. Yeah, just dog shit. Just so bad. And then Totally Angelica, that one's just horrible.
Yeah.
No effort goes into that game. That one I managed to at least play through all the other PS1 games. I played Totally Angelica. Enjoyed the opening cutscene to the PS1 version is like really decently done.
Yeah.
Like it's quite well animated. And then you get into the game and you go into one of the mini games and it's like clip art. It's bizarre.
Wow.
It's like it's Cynthia clip art, and you're just having to drag or choose the right outfit based on what it showed you at the beginning. Like, you just have to make her be in that outfit, and then you win the mini game.
Yeah.
Pick a hat, pick one ugly hat, and then the next one is like catch a bunch of cookies, and so you do it, and yay, you pick a t-shirt. And then the next one was a 4 minute long, like, auto running. It was like a ball mini game, and it sends the ball around this series of corridors, and the only thing you do is press the A button, or sorry, the X button.
Yeah.
The action button. You press the X button to hit the ball in the right direction, and it just does that for 4 minutes.
God.
It is horrible. It is so bad. Not even halfway through, I was going, how long is this? I was so bored. And then you get your trousers. And then there was some other mini game that I don't even remember, and you choose shoes. And then you go and you show off your outfit to the babies, and they give you a bad score, and then you have to go get more outfits.
Oh my God.
And that is the loop.
Wow. And
you need to get enough points to move further up in the mall. From what I could hear online, like, I read about it a bit, and it was like, apparently that is the whole game. It is by far the longest game and the least worthwhile to be playing for that long.
Oh dear.
It's the worst. It's so bad. So yeah, that was kind of the PS1 Rugrats experience. And honestly, like I said to you outside of the episode, Sam, the most interesting thread to follow was Search for Reptar, because there was so much more to that. Not that I tried particularly hard, but I couldn't find very much on the other games anyway.
Yeah.
And didn't have a lot of incentive to do so, because it was pretty obvious that those ones were just like, we got to get more Rugrats games out now.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, exactly.
Increasingly so as it went along, because the quality does just take a nosedive.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that was Rugrats games, I guess.
Wow. That's, yeah, gosh. I genuinely love when I'm able to, like, actually, like, learn new stuff from this. Because you know me, you know I hoard the game trivia and I stand over it like a grand wizard, so.
Exactly. It's only now that you've found your purpose for hoarding all this great knowledge.
It's spewed out in incredibly esoteric form.
Exactly. You finally have an outlet for all of this input you've had over the years.
Yes. Very true.
But yeah, especially when I found that Rugrats design document, that was just like, oh yes, yeah. I was so hoping you wouldn't have stumbled across that, because
yeah,
it was such a juicy find.
Oh, I love stuff like that for sure.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, thank you so much for coming on, Kit. Do you have anything to plug in particular, or anywhere you'd like to direct people to?
Not currently. The only things that I would direct people to is that design document. Please look at it. It's incredible. I'm hoping that by the time next time I come on the pod, because I fully intend to be on again.
Yeah, sure.
Not that I'm writing myself in. But,
there's but buyers!
what about you, Sam?
Well, you can find me at Sammy_Crow on Twitter and all the other platforms. I will see if I can give David a prod to put the games we've talked about on the backlogs that we have for the podcast as well, because that's always fun to add to the increasing tomes of games that we've discussed on the pod. Yeah, thank you very much for listening. Thank you for listening to us talking about baby shows and cartoon scribbles and the trials and tribulations of licensed game hell and heaven.
Yes.
Equal measure. And as always, that's keep right. gaming.
It's the happy, happy, joy, joy song. Happy, happy, joy, joy. 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 Happy, happy, joy, joy, joy. I don't think you're happy enough. That's right. I'll teach you to be happy. I'll teach your grandmother to suck eggs. Now, boys and girls, let's try it again.